Well, actually, we should say that those of you who've been listening to the broadcast that we've been having on KFJC since about 1979, 1980, know that we have talked at great length and in almost nauseating detail, nauseating at least to any citizen with an ounce of scruples and belief in good government, about the connections between our intelligence establishment and not only ours, of course, but many intelligence establishments and the drug trade. The fact that as the intelligence establishments began to become things unto themselves after World War II, and as they began to go with a policy of basically the Cold War policy of continuous engagement at low level, and it, as is becoming even more important in the Reagan 1980s, when the whole Cold War philosophy of small brushfire wars has become the order of the day, well, it's very difficult to fund these types of wars with through normal legitimate and legal political means, because most of the American people don't want to see their representatives voting for things like aid to the Contras, aid to the Mujahideen above a certain amount, things of that nature. And especially they don't want to see people supporting, say, the White Hand death squads in El Salvador and Guatemala and places like that, which many times our intelligence and political establishments have felt to be the order of the day for continuing their anti-communist political philosophies. And as a result, they have to go elsewhere for money and undetectable sums of money. And they found that the best ways to do this are gun running, drug running, or combinations thereof. And we have spent the last several months on these Radio Free America broadcasts looking in quite a bit of depth at how that has come to evolve as a national strategy, especially for the United States, but also for the Western nations in general.
Now, on this evening's broadcast, we're going to be taking a look at the intelligence services, particularly the CIA's role in the LSD phenomenon. Once again, we will see the Central Intelligence Agency involved in a pivotal way in the actual trafficking in LSD, and we'll also see the interrelationship between the LSD traffic and the arms traffic, a theme that's become almost numbing and certainly fairly depressing over the quill, as we've examined it over the course of these broadcasts, and indeed I think that could be safely said of the entire overview of the guns and drugs trades, which are in fact one trade and very closely interrelated. On this evening's broadcast, we're going to begin by taking a look at the growth of the LSD phenomenon, specifically the spread of LSD in American society is inextricable with the activities of the CIA and military in the United States. And we're going to begin taking a look at how LSD and its use and testing began out of a CIA program in order that was basically a search for a truth serum. We're going to take a look at the way in which the CIA's research into LSD spurred LSD research all around the country. Then we're going to take a look at the actual growth of the LSD subculture, so to speak. In particular, we're going to take a look at some of the main proponents of LSD, or the use of LSD for recreational purposes. We're going to take a look at a guy named Captain Al Hubbard, who, unlike Ken Kesey or Tim Leary, was the original LSD pioneer. He also was a lifelong U.S. intelligence agent and a very, very mysterious character. We're going to take a look at the ubiquitous role of the CIA in the spreading of the LSD doctrine, so to speak, to leading American intellectuals, whether we're looking at the aforementioned Tim Leary or Ken Kesey, whether we're looking at Aldous Huxley, whether we're looking at Allen Ginsberg. In the background of each of these key LSD proselytizers' introduction to that drug, we find the Central Intelligence Agency and people who were pivotally involved in the CIA's efforts to, in the CIA's testing efforts. LSD research was virtually unknown in this country until the CIA, through a number of domestic funding conduits, began pumping millions of dollars into research with this drug. We're going to take a look at the CIA's role in the Summer of Love, the 20th anniversary of which is about to be to break upon us here in the Bay Area with a lot of, and this is my editorial comment, revolting commemorations of that phenomenon. And it should be said, too, that the book that we're going to rely on for a lot of our broadcast this evening, although it has a lot of excellent information, does wax, I find, nauseatingly maudlin with regard to the psychedelic era, quote-unquote. There's the book sort of splits between devastating and insightful analysis and a lot of essentially nostalgic and I think fairly useless rumination and reminiscing about the glories of the psychedelic era. Whatever one, what conclusion one comes to about just what the CIA and other intelligence agencies were up to with regard to the use of LSD. Again, for the purposes of brevity, the thesis of the entire broadcast this evening is basically that the CIA is totally inseparable from the LSD phenomenon in America, whether we look at LSD as a research tool, as it was initially, or whether we look at it as the underground recreational drug of choice that it became in the 1960s. Throughout the growth and spread of the LSD phenomenon, the CIA is there, and again, are completely inseparable from it. At the end of the broadcast this evening, we're going to speculate to a certain extent about some of the things that they may have had in mind with their efforts.
That's right. Not only for you you ex-hippies out there, not only is 1987 the 20th anniversary of the, quote, Summer of Love, unquote, it's also the 40th anniversary of the formation of the CIA. And for those of you out there who are not previously familiar with the overlap that Dave mentioned between those two phenomena, you will be probably rather interested to stay tuned with us for tonight's broadcast. I just also wanted to mention that the book that we're going to be using heavily, not exclusively, but almost exclusively tonight, as Dave mentioned, is a book called Acid Dreams, subtitled The CIA, LSD, and the 60s Rebellion. The book is written by Martin A. Lee and Bruce Schlain, S-H-L-A-I-N, copyright 1985 by Grove Press, New York, and it is certainly worth your while. It is out right now. It is available, I think, in a lot of bookstores. It is probably also available in your local libraries and a variety of other places, and we are going to be covering a lot of it tonight, but obviously we cannot read the entire book to you, and it wouldn't hurt at all to go out and buy a copy and support researchers doing this kind of work. So, again, that small commercial over. Acid Dreams is the book we're going to be quoting from heavily tonight.
Okay, and again, we're going to begin by taking a look at the history of the CIA's research into LSD and the military's research into LSD, and observe the manner in which their interest in acid, which grew out of a number of different CIA mind control programs, part of which focused on the search for truth serum. Basically, this is where LSD got its start in American society. It was, as we're going to read here very shortly, virtually an unknown phenomenon. There was almost no one doing LSD research in the United States until the CIA began pumping a lot of capital into that type of research. All of a sudden, there were a lot of people doing that research. Very quickly, the drug spread from the laboratory to the street, and we will be analyzing the possible role of the CIA in effecting that switch deliberately.
All right, starting out from Acid Dreams and reading about the early days of the search for a truth serum or a truth drug that would enable interrogators to basically pick the brains clean. This was the original idea, pick the brains clean of foreign spies.
It should be noted here that in the search for a truth serum, the CIA picked up where the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, left off during World War II, the OSS being America's wartime intelligence service during WW2.
After the war, the CIA and the military picked up where the OSS had left off in the secret search for a truth serum. The Navy took the lead when it initiated Project Chatter in 1947, the same year that the CIA was formed. Described as, quote, an offensive program, Chatter was supposed to devise means of obtaining information from people independent of their volition, but without physical duress. Toward this end, Dr. Charles Savage conducted experiments with mescaline, a semi-synthetic extract of the peyote cactus that produces hallucinations similar to those caused by LSD, at the Naval Medical Research Institute in Bethesda, Maryland. But these studies, which involved animal as well as human subjects, did not yield an effective truth serum, and Chatter was terminated in 1953. The Navy became interested in mescaline as an interrogation agent when American investigators learned of mind control experiments carried out by the Nazi doctors at the Dachau concentration camp during World War II. After administering the hallucinogen to 30 prisoners, the Nazis concluded that it was, quote, impossible to impose one's will on another person, as in hypnosis, even when the strongest dose of mescaline had been given, unquote. But the drug still afforded certain advantages to SS interrogators, who were consistently able to draw, quote, even the most intimate secrets from the subject when questions were cleverly put. Not surprisingly, quote, sentiments of hatred and revenge were exposed in every case, unquote. The mescaline experiments at Dachau were described in a lengthy report by the U.S. Naval Technical Mission, which swept across Europe in search of every scrap of industrial material and scientific data that could be garnered from the fallen Reich. This mission set the stage for the wholesale importation of more than 600 top Nazi scientists under the auspices of Project Paperclip, which the CIA supervised during the early years of the Cold War. Among those who emigrated to the U.S. in such a fashion was Dr. Hubertus Strughold, spelled Strughold, the German scientist whose chief subordinates, Dr. Sigmund Ruff and Dr. Sigmund Rascher, were directly involved in, quote, aviation medicine experiments at Dachau, which included the mescaline studies. Despite recurring allegations that he sanctioned medical atrocities during the war, Strughold settled in Texas and became an important figure in America's space program. After Wernher von Braun, he was the top Nazi scientist employed by the American government, and he was subsequently hailed by NASA as the, quote, father of space medicine, unquote. The CIA, meanwhile, had launched an intensive research effort geared toward developing special interrogation techniques. Two methods showed promise in the late 1940s. The first involved narcohypnosis, in which a CIA psychiatrist attempted to induce a trance state after administering a mild sedative. A second technique involved a combination of two different drugs with a contradictory effect. A heavy dose of barbiturates was given to knock the subject out, and then he received an injection of a stimulant, usually some type of amphetamine. As he started to come out of a somnambulant state, he would reach a certain ineffable point prior to becoming fully conscious. Described in CIA documents as, quote, the twilight zone, this groggy condition was considered optimal for interrogation. CIA doctors attempted to extend the stuporous limbo as long as possible. In order to maintain the delicate balance between consciousness and unconsciousness, an intravenous hookup was inserted in both the subject's arms. One set of works contained a downer, the other an upper. The classic goofball effect. With a mere flick of the finger, an interrogator could regulate the flow of chemicals. The idea was to produce a, quote, push, a sudden outpouring of thoughts, emotions, confidences, and whatnot. Along this line, various combinations were tested. Secanol and dexedrine, pentothal and dizoxin, and, depending on the whim of the spy in charge, some marijuana, the old OSS standby, which the CIA referred to as sugar, might be thrown in for good measure.
Continuing with acid dreams. The goofball approach was not a precision science. There were no strictly prescribed rules or operating procedures regarding what drugs should be employed in a given situation. The CIA interrogators were left to their own devices, and a certain degree of recklessness was perhaps inevitable. In one case, a group of CIA experts hastily drafted a memo after reviewing a report prepared by one of the agency's special interrogation teams. The medical consultants pointed out that, quote, the amounts of scopolamine administered were extremely heavy, unquote. They also noted that the best results were obtained when two or at most three different chemicals were used in a session. In this case, however, heavy doses of scopolamine were administered along with thiamine, sodium luminol, atropine sulfate, sodium pentothal, and caffeine sulfate. One of the CIA's professional consultants in H techniques also questioned why hypnosis was attempted, quote, after a long and continuous use of chemicals, after the subject had vomited, and after apparently a maximum tolerance point had been reached with the chemicals, unquote. Everyone who read the interrogation report agreed that hypnosis was useless, if not impossible, under such conditions. Nevertheless, the memo concluded by reaffirming that, quote, no criticism is intended whatsoever, unquote, and that, quote, the choice of operating weapons must be left to the agents in the field. Despite the potential hazards and tenuousness of the procedure as a whole, special interrogations were strongly endorsed by the agency officials. A CIA document dated November 26, 1951, announced, quote, we're now convinced that we can maintain a subject in a controlled state for a much longer period of time than we heretofore had believed possible. Furthermore, we feel that by use of certain chemicals or combinations, we can, in a very high percentage of cases, produce relevant information, unquote. Although these techniques were still considered experimental, the prevailing opinion among members of the special interrogation teams was that there had been enough experiments, quote, to justify giving the green light to operational use of the techniques, unquote. And again quoting, there will be many a failure, a CIA scientist acknowledged, but he was quick to stress that every success with this method will be pure gravy. In an effort to expand its research program, the CIA contacted academics and other outside experts who specialize in areas of mutual interest. Liaison was established with the research sections of police departments and criminology laboratories. Medical practitioners, professional hypnotists, and psychiatrists were brought on as paid consultants, and various branches of the military provided assistance. Oftentimes, these arrangements involved a cover to conceal the CIA's interest in behavior modification. With the bureaucratic apparatus already in place, the CIA's mind control efforts were integrated into a single project under the code name Bluebird. Due to the extreme sensitivity of the project, the usual channels of authorization were bypassed. Instead of going through Project's review committee, the proposal for Bluebird was submitted directly to CIA Director Roscoe Hillenkoetter, last name H-I-L-L-E-N-K-O-E-T-T-E-R, who authorized the use of unvouchered funds to finance the hush-hush undertaking. Let me read that last sentence again. Due to the extreme sensitivity of the project, the usual channels of authorization were bypassed. Instead of going through the project's review committee, the proposal for Bluebird was submitted directly to CIA Director Roscoe Hillenkoetter, who authorized the use of such unvouchered funds to finance the hush-hush undertaking. With this seal of approval, the CIA's first major drug testing program was officially hatched. Bluebird was to remain a carefully guarded secret, for if word of the program leaked out, it would have been a great embarrassment and a detriment to American intelligence. As one CIA document put it, quote, Bluebird material was, quote, not fit for public consumption, unquote. From the outset, the CIA's mind control program had an explicit domestic angle. It's a very important sentence, and we should store this away for future reference in this broadcast. Beginning again, from the outset, the CIA's mind control program had an explicit domestic angle. A memo dated July 13, 1951, described the agency's mind-bending efforts as, quote, broad and comprehensive, involving domestic and overseas activities, and taking into consideration the programs and objectives of other departments, principally the military services, unquote, end quote. Bluebird activities were designed to create an exploitable alteration of personality, unquote, in selected individuals. Specific targets included, quote, potential agents, defectors, refugees, POWs, and a vague category of others, unquote. A number of units within the CIA participated in this endeavor, including the Inspection and Security Staff, the forerunner of the Office of Security, which assumed overall responsibility for running the program and dispatching the special interrogation teams. Colonel Sheffield Edwards, the chairman of the Bluebird Steering Committee, consistently pushed for a more reliable speech-inducing substance. By the time Bluebird evolved into Operation Artichoke, the formal change in code names occurred in August of 1951, security officials were still searching for the magic technique, the Deus Ex Machina, that would guarantee surefire results. I'm going to run back here and read a footnote. Now, it should be noted here that the search for the truth serum got its impetus to a certain extent from the OSS's wartime activities and received some direction from the research done into the mind-altering effects of chemicals conducted by the Nazi scientists and intelligence officials that were brought into this country at the end of World War II. We've gone into that connection at great length on these tapes. It should be noted that one of the things which it couldn't be said that we inherited it from this Nazi group, because human beings had been used for the purposes of unwitting experimentation before in American society. We talked about the famous Tuskegee experiment in our Radio Free America program 16, but it should be noted that the importation of all of these Third Reich alumni at the end of the war spurred in a tremendous way the inclination of American national security officials to use human beings as experimental guinea pigs. This was already going on with regard to the search for the truth serum and some of the mind control techniques incorporated under Project Bluebird and Operation Artichoke, the project we're about to examine. However, even at this early stage, using people as human guinea pigs resulted in a problem. Namely, what do you do with the guinea pigs after the experiment is over? The various contingencies derived by the intelligence services and CIA were discussed in Acid Dreams as follows. In a footnote to the passage we just read, obtaining information was only one aspect of the interrogation process. Even when CIA officers were able to loosen a subject's tongue, other problems remained, such as how to ensure that he would not remember the events that transpired during his stint in the Twilight Zone. Quote, if by some means we could create a perfect and thoroughly controlled amnesia, a CIA agent declared, the matter would be simplified, but amnesia is not certain and cannot be guaranteed. Certain drugs were known to produce amnesia for a matter of hours or days, but this was not sufficient. The CIA also had access to chemicals capable of causing permanent brain damage, but long-term amnesia drugs that would be completely reversible over a 12 to 18 month period were not available. This was quite an inconvenience as far as the national security experts were concerned. The question of what to do with subjects of special interrogation sessions, the disposal problem, unquote, provoked a heated debate inside the company. The immediate objective was to find a way of holding them, quote, in maximum custody until either operations have progressed to the point where their knowledge is no longer highly sensitive, or the knowledge they possess in general will be of no use to the enemy, unquote. One possibility suggested in CIA documents was to render a person incoherent through psychological and or pharmacological attack, and then have him placed in a mental institution. An unspecified number of subjects were committed involuntarily to insane asylums, including some who were described in CIA memoranda as mentally sound. This practice, which began in the early 1950s and continued at least until the mid-1960s, invites obvious comparisons to the incarceration of Russian dissidents in psychiatric hospitals because of their political views. Another option involved termination with extreme prejudice, unquote, CIA lingo for assassination, but this was hardly an ideal solution in all situations. In one CIA document, the question of disposal was discussed under the heading Lobotomy and Related Operations. A number of individuals who were fully cognizant of the disposal problem suggested that lobotomy, quote, might be the answer, or at least a partial solution, unquote. They argued that lobotomy would create a person, quote, who no longer cared, unquote, who had lost all initiative and drive, whose allegiance to ideal or motivating factors no longer existed, and who would probably have, if not complete amnesia, at least a fuzzy or spotty memory for recent and past events. They also pointed out, quote, that certain lobotomy types of operations were simple, quickly performed, and not too dangerous, unquote. Along this line, a group of CIA scientists entertained the possibility of using an ice pick lobotomy to render an individual harmless, quote, from a security point of view, unquote. A memo dated February 7, 1952, notes that on numerous occasions after using electroshock to produce anesthesia, an unidentified surgeon in the Washington, D.C. area performed an operation that involved destroying brain tissue by piercing the skull just above the eye with a fine surgical ice pick. This type of psychosurgery had certain advantages in that it resulted in nervous, confusional, and amnesia effects, unquote, without leaving a telltale scar, unquote. The CIA also experimented with brain surgery via UHF sound waves, and at one point during the early 1950s attempted to create a microwave amnesia beam that would destroy memory neurons. Not all CIA officials, however, favored using lobotomy as a disposal technique. Potential drawbacks were cited. Surgical risk was great, brain damage could be extensive, and such an operation, if faulty, could produce a vegetable, unquote. Moreover, if the enemy discovered that the CIA was mutilating people's brains for the sake of national security, this information could be exploited as a propaganda weapon. Other CIA officials opposed lobotomy because it was blatantly inhumane and violated all concepts of fair play and the American way of life, and thus it could never be officially sanctioned or supported. A CIA document dated March 3, 1952 states that, quote, while the USSR and its satellites are capable of any conceivable atrocity against human beings to attain what they think are their ends, we should not, with our high regard for human life, use these techniques unless by using them we save the lives of our own people and the situation is highly critical to the nation's safety. The ambiguous wording of that last sentence is something to mull over. The major point of this footnote being that with the inclination towards unwitting human experimentation that stemmed from the CIA's mind control operations, and which in turn gained impetus, as I said, from the Third Reich alumni that we brought in at the end of the war, a, quote, disposal problem arose. And I think some of the ethical tangles of the entire LSD program are themselves exposed and highlighted rather nicely by this problem. Aficionados of the underground television series The Prisoner may want to think about this some, too, because as that series would indicate, that at least on certain occasions, art imitates life.
Indeed. And as the... Dave made the point, it's very important to realize that a lot of the direct information that initially went into the CIA's mind control, interrogation, and later behavioral control investigations came directly out of the records of people like Dr. Hubertus Strughold in Dachau, and Strughold, who of course then later was brought into the United States and feted with all sorts of honors and called father of the space program, along with Wernher von Braun and Walter K. Dornberger, a couple of other real princes who, among other things, in the prison camp that served as their workshop, used to string people up on wires as an example to other prisoners. But Strughold used to do things like injecting people with gasoline, shooting them to see how quickly the wounds would congeal under certain types of conditions, freezing them to death in ice cold water, and all kinds of stuff. This is one of the fathers of our space program. With this as an example, and these people being regarded as useful and worthwhile influences for the CIA to bring into the United States, it's very little surprise that a little later on in the program that the CIA wouldn't find any ethical problems with jamming an ice pick into somebody's brain because they were a security problem. Again, an innocent human volunteer, not a Soviet spy.
This is by way of showing not only the early progress of the mind control programs of the CIA, which gave direct rise to the LSD phenomenon in the United States, but by way of showing the moral and historical background to the LSD phenomenon. As we will repeat later in the broadcast, if this is your idea of peace and love, I'd hate to see your idea of hate and war.
Continuing with Acid Dreams, it's from a section labeled Enter LSD. It was with the hope of finding the long-sought miracle drug that CIA investigators first began to dabble with LSD-25 in the early 1950s. At the time, very little was known about the hallucinogen, even in scientific circles. Dr. Wernher Stoll, the son of Sandoz president Arthur Stoll and a colleague of Albert Hofmann's, was the first person to investigate the psychological properties of LSD. The results of his study were presented in the Swiss Archives of Neurology in 1947. Stoll reported that LSD produced disturbances in perception, hallucinations, and acceleration in thinking. Moreover, the drug was found to blunt the usual suspiciousness of schizophrenic patients. No unfavorable after effects were described. 2 years later, in the same journal, Stoll contributed a second report entitled, quote, "A New Hallucinatory Agent Active in Very Small Amounts," unquote. The fact that LSD caused hallucinations should not have been a total surprise to the scientific community. Sandoz first became interested in ergot, E-R-G-O-T, the natural source of lysergic acid, because of numerous stories passed down through the ages. The rye fungus had a mysterious, that's rye, R-Y-E, not W-R-Y, they're not anthropomorphizing it. The rye fungus had a mysterious and contradictory reputation. In China and parts of the Mideast, it was thought to possess medicinal qualities, and certain scholars believe that it may have been used in sacred rites in ancient Greece. In other parts of Europe, however, the same fungus was associated with a horrible malady known as St. Anthony's Fire, which struck periodically like the plague. Medieval chronicles tell of villages and towns where nearly everyone went mad for a few days after ergot-diseased rye was unknowingly milled into flour and baked as bread. Men were afflicted with gangrenous limbs that looked like blackened stumps, and pregnant women miscarried. Even in modern times, there have been reports of ergot-related epidemics. The CIA inherited this ambiguous legacy when it embraced LSD as a mind-control drug. An artichoke document, Operation Artichoke, by the way, was another CIA mind control program coming out of Operation Bluebird. An artichoke document, dated October 21st, 1951, indicates that acid was tested initially as part of a pilot study of the effects of various chemicals, quote, "on the conscious suppression of experimental or non-threat secrets." In addition to lysergic acid, this particular survey covered a wide range of substances, including morphine, ether, benzedrine, ethyl alcohol, and mescaline. Quote, "There is no question," noted the author of this report, "that drugs are already on hand, and new ones are being produced, that can destroy integrity and make indiscreet the most dependable individual." The report concluded by recommending that LSD be critically tested, quote, "under threat conditions beyond the scope of civilian experimentation," unquote. POWs, federal prisoners, and security officers were mentioned as possible candidates for these field experiments. In another study, designed to ascertain optimal dosage levels, for interrogation sessions, a CIA psychiatrist administered LSD to, quote, at least 12 human subjects of not too high mentality, unquote. At the outset, the subjects were, quote, told only that a new drug was being tested and promised that nothing serious or dangerous would happen to them. During the intoxication, they realized something was happening, but were never told exactly what, unquote. A dosage range of 100 to 150 micrograms was finally selected, and the agency proceeded to test the drug in mock interrogation trials. Initial reports seemed promising. In one instance, LSD was given to an officer who had been instructed not to reveal, quote, a significant military secret. When questioned, however, quote, he gave all the details of the secret, and after the effects of the LSD had worn off, the officer had no knowledge of revealing the information, complete amnesia, unquote. Favorable reports kept coming in, and when this phase of experimentation was completed, the CIA's Office of Scientific Intelligence, OSI, prepared a lengthy memorandum entitled Potential New Agent for Unconventional Warfare. LSD was said to be useful, quote, for eliciting true and accurate statements from subjects under its influence during interrogation, unquote. Moreover, the data on hand suggested that LSD might help in reviving memories of past experiences.
Now, the next section of Acid Dreams that we're going to look at underscores the manner in which it was the very research which we now see being in our historical retrospective here, which we see being undertaken in the early 1950s under the auspices of Operation Artichoke, that it was the push to develop this mind control and ostensibly, at least, or initially, truth serum drug, which was what the CIA was looking for with LSD. This is what brought the LSD research into our society. Initially, there was almost no one doing LSD research, and the very research programs that we're talking about here was what brought LSD into American society. Again, hardly anybody was doing anything one way or the other with LSD as a result of the CIA's programs to test this drug as a possible truth serum, mind control drug, and what have you. LSD became a major, major asset to American, not asset, but a major adjunct to American psychological research. We're going to take a look at that now, the experimentation programs undertaken on human subjects, and the manner in which, literally, LSD came from the CIA. Returning to Acid Dreams. When the CIA first became interested in LSD, only a handful of scientists in the United States were engaged in hallucinogenic drug research. At the time, there was little private or public support for this relatively new field of experimental psychiatry, and no one had undertaken a systematic investigation of LSD. The CIA's mind control specialists sensed a golden opportunity in the making. With a sizable treasure chest at their disposal, they were in a position to boost the careers of scientists whose skill and expertise would be of maximum benefit to the CIA. Almost overnight, a whole new market for grants and LSD research sprang into existence as money started pouring through CIA-linked conduits or cutouts, such as the Geschichter Fund for Medical Research, the Society for the Study of Human Ecology, and the Josiah Macy Jr. Foundation. Among those who benefited from the CIA's largesse was Dr. Max Rinkel, R-I-N-K-E-L, the first person to bring LSD to the United States. In 1949, Rinkel, a research psychiatrist, obtained a supply of LSD from Sandoz Pharmaceuticals in Switzerland and gave the drug to his partner, Dr. Robert Hyde, who took the first acid trip in the Western Hemisphere. Rinkel and Hyde went on to organize an LSD study at the Boston Psychopathic Institute, a pioneering mental health clinic affiliated with Harvard University. They tested the drug on 100 volunteers and reported the initial findings in May of 1950, nearly 3 years before the CIA began funding their work, at the annual meeting of the American Psychiatric Association. Rinkel announced that LSD produced, quote, a transitory psychotic disturbance, unquote, in normal subjects. This was highly significant, for it raised the possibility that mental disorders could be studied objectively in a controlled experimental setting. Rinkel's hypothesis was supported and expanded upon during the same forum by Dr. Paul Hoch, or Hoch, H-O-C-H, a prominent psychiatrist who would also proffer his services to the CIA in the years ahead. Hoch reported that the symptoms produced by LSD, mescaline, and related drugs were similar to those of schizophrenia. Intensity of color perception, hallucinations, depersonalization, intense anxiety, paranoia, and in some cases, catatonic manifestations. As Hoch put it, quote, LSD and mescaline disorganize the psychic integration of the individual, unquote. He believed that the medical profession was fortunate to have access to these substances, for now it would be possible to reconstruct temporary or model psychoses in the laboratory. LSD was considered an exceptional research tool in that the subject could provide a detailed description of his experience while he was under the influence of the drug. It was hoped that careful analysis of these data would shed new light on schizophrenia and other enigmatic mental diseases. Hoke's landmark thesis, that LSD was a psychotomimetic or madness-mimicking agent, caused a sensation in scientific circles and led to several important and stimulating theories regarding the biochemical basis of schizophrenia. This, in turn, sparked an upsurge of interest in brain chemistry and opened new vistas in the field of experimental psychiatry. In light of the extremely high potency of LSD, it seemed completely plausible that infinitesimal traces of a psychoactive substance produced through metabolic dysfunction by the human organism might cause psychotic disturbances. Conversely, attempts to alleviate a lysergic psychosis, unquote, might point the way toward curing schizophrenia and other forms of mental illness. As it turned out, the model psychosis concept dovetailed particularly well with the secret schemes of the CIA, which also viewed LSD in terms of its ability to blow minds and make people crazy. Thus, it is not surprising that the CIA chose to invest in men like Wrinkle and Hoke. Most scientists were flattered by the government's interest in their research, and they were eager to assist the CIA in its attempts to unravel the riddle of LSD. This was, after all, the Cold War, and one did not have to be a Blue Ribbon hawk or a hardliner to work in tandem with American intelligence. In the early 1950s, the CIA approached Dr. Nick Bercel, B-E-R-C-E-L, a psychiatrist who maintained a private practice in Los Angeles. Bercel was one of the first people in the United States to work with LSD, and the CIA asked him to consider a haunting proposition. What would happen if the Russians put LSD in the water supply of a large American city? A skillful saboteur could carry enough acid in his coat pocket to turn an entire metropolis into a loony bin, assuming he found a way to distribute it equally. In light of this frightening prospect, would Bercel render a patriotic service by calculating exactly how much LSD would be required to contaminate the water supply of Los Angeles? Bercel consented, and that evening he dissolved a tiny amount of acid in a glass of tap water, only to discover that the chlorine neutralized the drug. "Don't worry," he told his CIA contact, "it won't work." Remember this scenario of dosing American reservoirs later. We're going to come in contact with an interesting proposition by Timothy Leary in that regard.
Another interesting proposition right here is the fact that the CIA presented it apparently to Dr. Bercel as being something they were worried that a Soviet saboteur might do, and when he told them it wouldn't work, well, we'll see. Continuing, the agency took this as a mandate, and another version of LSD was eventually concocted to overcome this drawback. A CIA document states accordingly, quote, "If the concept of contaminating a city's water supply seems, or in actual fact, is found to be far-fetched, this is by no means certain, there is still the possibility of contaminating, say, the water supply of a bomber base, or, more easily still, that of a battleship. Our current work contains the strong suggestion that LSD-25 will produce hysteria, unaccountable laughing, anxiety, terror. It requires little imagination to realize what the consequences might be if a battleship's crew were so affected," unquote. The CIA never got in touch with Bercel again, but they monitored his research reports in various medical journals. When Bercel gave LSD to spiders, they spun perfectly symmetrical webs. Animal studies also showed that cats cringed before untreated mice, and fish that normally swam close to the bottom of a water tank hovered near the top. In another experiment, Dr. Louis Jolly West, chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Oklahoma, injected an elephant with a massive dose of 300,000 micrograms. Dr. West, a CIA contract employee and an avid believer in the notion that hallucinogens were psychotomimetic agents, was trying to duplicate the periodic, quote, rut madness that overtakes male elephants for about 1 week each year. But the animal did not experience a model elephant psychosis. It just keeled over and remained in a motionless stupor. In attempting to revive the elephant, West administered a combination of drugs that ended up killing the poor beast. Research on human subjects showed that LSD lodged primarily in the liver, spleen, and kidneys. Only a tiny amount, 0.01%, of the original dose entered the brain, and it only remained there for 20 minutes. This was a most curious finding, as the effect of LSD was not evident until the drug had disappeared entirely from the central nervous system. Some scientists thought that LSD might act as a trigger mechanism, releasing or inhibiting a naturally occurring substance in the brain, but no one could figure out exactly why the drug had such a dramatic effect on the mind. Many other questions were in need of clarification. Could the drug be fatal? Well, parenthetically, obviously it could to elephants anyway. What was the maximum dose? Were the effects constant or were there variations according to different personality types? Could the reaction be accentuated by combining LSD with other chemicals? Was there an antidote? Some of these questions overlapped with legitimate medical concerns, and researchers on CIA stipends published unclassified versions of their work in prestigious scientific periodicals. But these accounts omitted secret data given to the CIA on how LSD affected, quote, operationally pertinent categories, such as disturbance of memory, alteration of sex patterns, eliciting information, increasing suggestibility, and creating emotional dependence.
Continuing.
We actually, if we're going to try and get a 45-minute break for people to flip tapes, we should probably do it now.
Oh, okay. Why don't we read one more section here,
okay.
then we'll give them a chance to. Continuing with acid dreams. The CIA was particularly interested in psychiatric reports suggesting that LSD could break down familiar behavior patterns, for this raised the possibility of reprogramming or brainwashing. If LSD temporarily altered a person's view of the world and suspended his belief system, CIA doctors surmised, then perhaps Russian spies could be cajoled into switching loyalties while they were tripping. This brainwashing strategy was relatively simple. Find the subject's weakest point, his squeaky board, unquote, and bear down on it. Use any combination or synthesis which might, quote, open the mind to the power of suggestion to a degree never hitherto dreamed possible, unquote. LSD would be employed to provoke a reality shift, to break someone down and tame him, to find a locus of anonymity and leave a mark there forever. To explore the feasibility of this approach, the agency turned to Dr. Ewan Cameron, C-A-M-E-R-O-N, a respected psychiatrist who served as president of the Canadian, the American, and the World Psychiatric Associations before his death in 1967. Cameron also directed the Alain Memorial Institute at Montreal's McGill University, where he developed a bizarre and unorthodox method for treating schizophrenia. With financial backing from the CIA, he tested his method on 53 patients at Alain, or Alain, A-L-L-A-I-N. The so-called treatment started with sleep therapy, unquote, in which subjects were knocked out for months at a time. The next phase, depatterning, entailed massive electroshock and frequent doses of LSD designed to wipe out past behavior patterns. Then Cameron tried to recondition the mind through a technique known as psychic driving, unquote. The patients, once again heavily sedated, were confined to sleep rooms, unquote, where tape-recorded messages played over and over from speakers under their pillows. Some heard the same message a quarter of a million times. Cameron's methods were later discredited, and the CIA grudgingly gave up the notion of LSD as a brainwashing technique. But that was little consolation to those who served as guinea pigs for the CIA's secret mind control projects. Nine of Cameron's former patients have sued the American government for $1 million each, claiming that they are still suffering from the trauma they went through at Alain. These people never agreed to participate in a scientific experiment, a fact which reflects little credit on the CIA, even if agency officials feared that the Soviets were spurting ahead in the mind control race. The CIA violated the Nuremberg Code for Medical Ethics by sponsoring experiments on unwitting subjects. Ironically, Dr. Cameron was a member of the Nuremberg Tribunal that heard the case against Nazi war criminals who committed atrocities during World War II. Like the Nazi doctors at Dachau, the CIA victimized certain groups of people who were unable to resist. Prisoners, mental patients, foreigners, the terminally ill, sexual deviants, and ethnic minorities. One project took place at the Addiction Research Center of the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital in Lexington, Kentucky. Lexington was ostensibly a place where heroin addicts could go to shake a habit, and although it was officially a penitentiary, all the inmates were referred to as patients. The patients had their own way of referring to the doctors, hacks, or croakers, unquote, who patrolled the premises in military uniforms. The patients at Lexington had no way of knowing that it was one of 15 penal and mental institutions utilized by the CIA in its super-secret drug development program. To conceal its role, the agency enlisted the aid of the Navy and the National Institutes of Mental Health, which served as conduits for channeling money to Dr. Harris Isbell, I-S-B-E-L-L, a gung-ho research scientist who remained on the CIA payroll for over a decade. According to CIA documents, the directors of NIMH and the National Institutes of Health were fully cognizant of the agency's interest in Isbell's work and offered full support and protection, unquote. When the CIA came across a new drug, usually supplied by American pharmaceutical firms that needed testing, they frequently sent it over to their chief doctor at Lexington, where an ample supply of captive guinea pigs was readily available. Over 800 compounds were farmed out to Isbell, including LSD and a variety of hallucinogens. It became an open secret among street junkies that if the supply got tight, you could always commit yourself to Lexington, where heroin and morphine were doled out as payment if you volunteered for Isbell's wacky drug experiments. Small wonder that Lexington had a return rate of 90%. Dr. Isbell, a longtime member of the Food and Drug Administration's Advisory Committee on the Abuse of Depressant and Stimulant Drugs, defended the volunteer system on the grounds that there was no precedent at the time for offering inmates cash for their services.
Okay, when we come back from a short break, we are going to be reading a little bit more about Dr. Isbell's CIA-funded and assisted experiments, and we're going to be talking more about the formation of the CIA's concept of LSD as a behavior control substance, even more than an interrogation technique.
For people who eventually hear this program via a rebroadcast, or for people who listen to it on tape, that will continue on the second side of this particular cassette series.
This is Nip Tuck. Dave Emery and I will be back with more of Radio Free America number 28 in just a few minutes right here on KFG.